You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon for what promises to be a very interesting discussion of what happens when warlords turn into bureaucrats based on the experience of Afghanistan. I'm Marina Ottaway, and I'm a senior associate in the Middle East program here. My main challenge today is going to introduce Dipali because I've never managed to pronounce her name correctly. So let me try and see. Dipali Mukhopadhyay, I think, or something along those lines, who has been researching. She's a doctoral candidate at the Fletcher School at Tufts, and he has been researching this issue of the performance of warlords that have been appointed by President Karzai to head provinces, essentially appointed as provincial governors. Karzai has been very widely criticized for having done this. It has been perceived the appointment of these former warlords has, and perhaps former is not the right word, of these warlords has been perceived essentially as a contradiction to his purpose of creating a democratic state, of setting up a more democratic form of administration. And certainly there are some very very serious issues that are raised by these appointments. I don't want to put words in the Dipali's mouth, but I think the results of her research really point to a much more complex and nuanced situation. Not a great resounding success in the appointment of warlords to this administrative position, but essentially a results that are not all that different from those of other appointments. To discuss the paper, we have two people, my colleague Gilles Doronsoro, and Marvin Weidenbaum. Gilles Doronsoro is a visiting scholar at Carnegie. He's an expert on Afghanistan. Some of you may have been here just a couple of weeks ago when he discussed his own paper, the results of his own travels in Afghanistan during the summer. Marvin Weidenbaum is professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, I should say, and has served as an analyst for Pakistan and Afghanistan in the U.S. Department of State at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research from 1999 to 2003. So he's also extremely familiar with the situation. Without further ado, because we don't have much point, Dipali.
Thank you so much, Marina. And thank you all for coming. Thanks especially to Marina Ottaway for supporting me in writing this paper. And it's a pleasure for me to have Gilles Doronsoro and Marvin Weinbaum discuss this subject with me. They're two scholars for whom I have great respect. So with that, I'll get started. And lay out kind of the broad outlines of the paper, which I've written. We know that after 2001, the US and its allies framed their goals in Afghanistan in very ambitious terms, namely to build a capable representative state governed by the rule of law rather than the rule of gun, and one that would provide an array of unprecedented goods and services to the population of the country. Today we hear a similar articulation of this goal, but now in the counterinsurgency paradigm, which seems to be drawing quite directly from the state-building paradigm. And so both of these paradigms seem to be in alignment, and yet we have an extraordinary gap between what was promised in 2001 and what has been delivered since. We're told that the Afghan state today is a hollow shell rotted from the inside by predation and inefficiency, And as Marina said, many observers, Afghan and foreign alike, point to the presence of warlords within the state since 2001 as the chief corrosive agent in this political space. What I'm arguing in this paper, however, is that there are a number of warlords who are practicing a kind of governance that has certain dividends for the population, for the central government, and the international community. And I'm calling this kind of governance hybrid governance, which is a combination of weak formal institutions and persistent informal power. This brand of governance comes at a cost, of course, but it does suggest that the choice in Afghanistan need not be a black and white one between success as defined as good governance or failure as defined as anarchic tribalism. On the other hand, this is a choice that we hear a lot today, and my argument is that there's evidence that this may be a false choice. Before I get into the details of my own casework on the two governors that I'm studying, I want to go back to this idea of the vision that was laid out by the international community from 2001 onwards. The roadmap for rebuilding the state actually represented the latest incarnation in an increasingly ambitious model for post-conflict reconstruction, which we've seen deployed in post-conflict countries across the world since the end of the Cold War. And that model had certain key elements, starting with elections and economic liberalization, but then the model deepened over the years into the promotion of rule of law, the establishment of civil and political rights, institutional checks and balances, and governance grounded in meritocracy and transparency. So ultimately, this model amounts to the goal of cultivating a strong and capable set of formal institutions of statehood that function much like those would in a mature Western country. There is little space in this model for informal or customary institutions or power holders of the kind we see as prevalent in a country like Afghanistan. So when you look at then the Afghan case specifically, you see this model beginning to unfurl itself with the Bonn Agreement passed in 2001, which laid out a roadmap for the creation of the formal state or the recreation of the formal state. The agreement called for the drafting of a constitution, free and fair elections, an independent judiciary, centrally controlled security sector, and provisions for women's and minority rights protection. And the roadmap has been followed, at least on paper, quite closely, the constitution drafted, presidential and parliamentary elections held in 2004, 2005, but of course peace and stability at the time remained elusive. So the international community met with the fledgling post-conflict state, and together they redoubled their commitment in the Afghan Compact, where they outlined a host of tasks that the state ought to take on and perform, and then passed this national development strategy in 2008, which provided ostensibly the way ahead to achieve those tasks, which would ultimately create a state that was competent, representative, responsive, and very well coordinated in order to link the capital to the countryside in this very robust way. So one document after the next then underscored the need for a strong and representative government. And we have good evidence from research done in the early years that, in fact, there was a great deal of popular support for a strong and credible centralized state amongst ordinary Afghans, having survived decades of brutal civil war. So with everyone on the same page, then the question is what went wrong and why has there been this gap between governance promised and governance delivered? Of course, there are a host of reasons which many scholars have written about, but I want to focus on a few that I think then lead us to this understanding of why hybrid governance has emerged. First, and this is, I'll just briefly touch on the notion of the nature of state building in general. For any student of state building knows the vast literature that explains the hundreds, if not thousands, of years that of bloody wars and conflict that ultimately resulted in the emergence of robust states in the Western world. So we know that state building is a long and messy process, and to think that this process could be accelerated and imported in such a short time frame with always under-resourced in itself is one good explanation for why the gap exists. But I think we can go into some more specific examples that again link back to this question of warlordism. And they include the counterterrorism imperative that drove intervention in Afghanistan to begin with, and then the history of the Afghan state itself. So I think to start, we have to go back to the original motivation behind the intervention, which was the response to September 11th. And what commenced was a military campaign to eliminate Al-Qaeda's safe haven in Afghanistan. And the military decision was to partner with a number of warlord commanders who had been struggling in their own way to defeat the Taliban regime. And this partnership, in a matter of months, resulted in the toppling of the regime. So this military campaign, both of the cases which I'm looking at, both of these commanders participated in this campaign. But of course, there were serious implications for the state building project, which would unfold thereafter. And in a sense, we can understand that the state building project was always in that way subordinate to the larger goal of counterterrorism. After fighting with the Americans, of course, these warlord commanders had newfound access to coercion, capital, and to the political space that they had not had before. And these are, I think one can argue, as several scholars have, that these are the constituent elements of informal power, this kind of access. And so these now empowered warlords represented potential competitors to the fledgling state. They were particularly threatening in the absence of any major international peace enforcement force on the ground, which we know was discussed extensively but never materialized. And so instead, from the Braun process forward, these commanders were engaged through an accommodationist approach. And through their participation at Bonn, they received a number of important portfolios and appointments and were essentially given the opportunity to shift their position from potential competitors to tenuous partners. They entered the state, bringing with them their informal affiliations, their networks, their resources, and so began this journey toward hybrid governance. So from that point of view, we understand that the state building project was profoundly affected by the military campaign, the first in the so-called global war on terror. But the limitations of governance in Afghanistan can also be understood as a function of the history and the struggles of the state itself over the last several centuries. So if we look back at the history of the Afghan state, I think two things become evident. First, the extraordinary challenges for the state of expanding its writ beyond the capital. And second, the persistent salience of informal actors, be they tribal, militant, religious, in the political space. So I've created this graphic representation. It's a crude representation of the history of the Afghan state. And the reason that I'm presenting this is to suggest that between the late 19th century and today, there have been a lot of ups and downs in the process of state formation in Afghanistan. Rulers who attempted to rapidly introduce models of strong and direct rule found themselves often without sufficient support from the periphery, with the exception of King Abdulrahman in the 19th century, who used a violent and pretty brutal techniques which modern-day state builders don't have access to. But if you look at King Amanullah in the early 20th century and then later in the 20th century, the communist regime, You see two regimes which sought to very radically redefine the relationship between the state and society in very modern terms that ultimately amounted to inserting the state into social, economic, political realms where it had not interfered before. Both, of course, resulted in quite stark failure. So these are important episodes to understand, and they're often highlighted and analogized to what the project that's underway today. But I think it's also important to recognize that there was a long stretch in the mid-20th century, which I think we can analogize to this, use this word hybrid governance to describe. This was the period of rule by the Musahiban kings, Nader Shah, his brothers, and eventually his son, Zahir Shah, the last king of Afghanistan. These brothers worked under Amanullah's regime in different capacities, learned lessons from his failure, and pulled the state back. And ultimately, in the words of anthropologist Tom Barfield, limited the scope of the state to keeping the peace, administering justice, see that conscription went smoothly, and collect small amounts of taxes. Despite the passage in 1964 of Zahir Shah's constitution, which promised participatory politics and reform, the changes that Zahir Shah made were really cosmetic, and ultimately, during this period of time, the state continued to represent an institution of last resort, and the politics, local politics and law of daily life were managed in the informal domain. So I think parallels can be drawn between the Musahiban approach and that of Karzai. Both regimes focused on regime preservation over state expansion and formed pacts with informal power holders of very different types. I'm not trying to say the power holders are similar in terms of their legitimacy, but these power holders had the capacity to dominate at the periphery, had the capacity to threaten the state, but also had the inclination, when engaged appropriately, to become partners of the state. And we can think, I think, of President Karzai's approach towards the warlords as part of a longer tradition then of accommodating competitors, some of which have even become partners of the regime. So then let's move into the present day context and understand this post-2001 political space as a kind of hybrid governance. And we see then the enormous gap that exists between this de facto politics and the de jure design of what the Bonn Agreement envisioned in terms of this maximalist state. And you see the gap that persists. So then the question is, what is hybrid governance looking like today? I think an argument can be made that there are warlords who are operating in the formal state at all levels of government across all branches, and there are a number of very interesting studies that are being done on them in different spaces. I'm focusing at the provincial level because I think this is an important political space in Afghanistan. It's where the center and the periphery meet, where the ordinary citizen is going to interact with the state at the provincial and local level, and where the absence of any strong formal institutional history, especially at the provincial and district level, makes the salience of informal power and formal institutions especially evident. So my argument is that what we have is the pacts between the state and the informal power holders. Now there's a third element in the post-conflict space, which is the international community. So it's a triangular relationship, and this bargaining dynamic that exists between these three players yields certain positive dividends and certain negative ones. So on the positive side, both of the warlord governors, who I'll go now into detail on, have delivered on security, reconstruction, and counter-narcotics. They've done so through, however, a politics that is continues to be marred by corruption, patronage dynamics, human rights abuse, and ultimately limited institutional growth. So what I want to do is explain those dynamics in these two cases now and then talk about the implications. This is the first governor who I've been studying. His name is Governor Atta Mohammed Noor. And here, it's a photograph of, I'm interviewing him this past summer when I was in Mazar-e-Sharif. Governor Atta comes from Balkh and joined the Mujahideen as a teenager and ultimately rose to command the 7th Corps. And in 2001 was approached and joined a team of special forces. And with the help of his major rival, Abdul Rashid Dostum, who many of you would have heard of, helped the Americans to take Mazar-i-Sharif from the Taliban, which was the first city to fall in this military campaign. He then resumed his position as the head of the 7th Corps in the interim military force, and in 2004 was appointed provincial governor, where he's been since. So to understand Atta Mohamed Noor and the hybrid governance that he's delivering at the provincial level, I think, is to understand him not only as the governor of the province, but as the key strongman of the province. Governor Atta has established a near monopoly on violence, and he's done that. He did that first by resisting the disarmament, attempts at disarmament that were made immediately after the new regime took power, until a political bargain was struck that took care of his rival, Abdul Rashid Dostum, by giving him a position in Kabul and ensured essentially that by being the governor of the province, he would then be the principal strongman in the region. He went further, however, after formally submitting his militia to disarmament, he ultimately, however, basically transplanted that militia network into the formal administration. And that means, by formal administration, I mean the provincial and district level administration and police. And then he's gone on to manage that militia network through patronage politics. And that kind of management has allowed him a degree of surveillance and penetration of the goings-on in the province, which is quite unusual for a provincial governor in the country, and there are dividends that come from that. So let me quickly explain what I saw in terms of this transplantation of the militia organization. What I found through approximately 50 interviews which I conducted in the province last summer was that the critical positions, for example, within the police administration throughout the province have been given to close subcommanders who abuse their positions of power within limits to extort bribes, engage in illicit economic activity, consolidate their own bases of support, with the knowledge that if their behavior becomes too problematic for the governor, they will be checked. And there is evidence and some colorful rumor about how that checking takes place. But then there are those that, who have not received positions within the administration are receiving a different kind of patronage from the governor in the form of plots of land to live on, employment in the private sector, and influence in the law and politics at the district and village level, which they may not have had before. I was invited by a number of Governor Atta's subcommanders to their homes on one such plot of land, where I witnessed them delivering advice to local elders about how to approach the governor with regard to different projects, and where one of the subcommanders explained to me that the relationship between Governor Atta and his former commanders is very much the same as it was before. So this kind of surveillance, this kind of relationship then allows for a degree of penetration, as I said, on the part of the governor in terms of having individuals loyal to him and under his control at every level of political life. One journalist explained this to me as, quote, an unofficial underground paid administration that really controls Balkh and looks after security and tries to track down those who are trying to make Balkh insecure. Another said to me, if we see this optimistically, we can say this has resulted in a more secure environment. From the other side, we can say this system of governance has resulted in a lack of rule of law, the absence of general respect for human rights values, and sometimes insecurity as well. What we see with this kind of insecurity, imperfect as it may be, is that it has drawn significant private investment for reconstruction and growth, especially in the city of Mazar. Businessmen have gone further, contributing to public works projects, including several traffic circles that are now famous across the country. And many observers speculate that these projects, which the businessmen frame as philanthropic, have been undertaken to secure the blessing and the protection of the governor. Similarly, this kind of penetration has enabled the governor to achieve significant success on the counter-narcotics front. While the governor and his staff in interviews that I had with them attributed their success to a strong political message coupled with capable law enforcement, other observers pointed to a racketeering dynamic. In the words of one journalist, when you ask a robber to take care of security, he is not going to rob. In Balkh, the traffickers and the police were often one and the same, these observers argue. And so the delivery, again and again, of a poppy-free province doesn't necessarily mean that the poppy problem has been solved in Balkh. But what it means is that the governor has the capacity, if so inclined, to carry out a national policy and to alter the behavior of a large number of his subjects in a fairly short period of time, and deliver what's been asked of him by the central government and the international community. So what we see then is that informal power is at the heart of Atta's governing strategy, but that hasn't precluded him from enhancing the technical capacity of his administration. We've seen some degree of public administration reform and capacity building. In one review done by UNDP of the reform process in Balkh, the following assessment was made. The governor's office is now able to work on coordinating with other line ministries, able to consolidate and work out provincial budgets, and able to deal with donor community wherever required, which is not an assessment that could be made of many governors in Afghanistan. The governor reached out to a private firm, Adam Smith International, to help him develop the first provincial five-year development plan in the country, which the governor then went on to present in Kabul. What's interesting about this technical capacity building is that it has not required the governor to give up his access to informal networks. It simply improves his administration's ability to deliver goods and services without compromising his personal hold on power. So that's my take on Governor Atta's version of hybrid governance. And now we move on to Governor Gulaga Shirzai, who sometimes goes by the nickname of the bulldozer. This is Governor Shirzai. Governor Shirzai does not come from Nangarhar province, where he's currently the governor, which Nangarhar is in the east of Afghanistan on the border with Pakistan. Governor Shirzai comes from Kandahar, where he served as governor before he had some problems with President Karzai's brother, Ahmed Wali Karzai, many of you would have heard of, and so ultimately was transferred to Nangarhar. He is a fellow Pashtun, but came to Nangarhar as an outsider nonetheless. So it's a very different dynamic, of course, than what Governor Atta experienced coming from Balkh and from what's considered a more stable part of the country. So Governor Shirzai, I think we can understand as a provincial governor, but we can also think about him in more traditional terms as a Khan, and I think that in that way we can think about his hybrid governance from this point of view. So he came to Nangarhar as a fellow Pashtun but an outsider, and adopted a newcomer strategy of co-opting tribal leaders who he thought would be key to his own success as a governor through political engagement and patronage. The governor also has taken advantage of the significant U.S. presence on the ground, sometimes leveraging American carrots and sticks in his own provincial patronage politics. So this is, of course, a different kind of strategy than Governor Atta has, who doesn't have an American presence and, in fact, instead has a small Swedish PRT. So this tribal strategy that Governor Shirzai has taken on has yielded a number of dividends, including the delivery of a poppy-free province after many years of high poppy cultivation in Nangarhar. My own interviews in Nangarhar, as well as those of drug economy expert David Mansfield, who's written extensively on Nangarhar and the poppy problem, suggested that the elimination of cultivation in Nangarhar can be largely attributed to a robust implementation of the national policy on the part of the governor's office. When I interviewed the governor and his staff, they argue that their success derived largely from a long and persistent campaign on the part of the governor to reach out to tribal elders and to convince them, in effect, that they needed to ensure that their community members did not plant poppy. He regularly engaged what one journalist described to me as the province's rentable elders, with feasts, gifts, and cash to gain their support and compliance. Shirzai also posed the threat of U.S. military action to those who grew poppy, according to farmers in the remote district of Achin. While the U.S. military presence in Nangarhar did not have a counter-narcotics mandate, the governor took the liberty of leveraging their presence on behalf of his own agenda. He also took routine opportunities to speak of his relationship with Mr. America and the rewards that relationship had produced in the form of many reconstruction and development province for this now poppy-free province. So the U.S. military presence presents an asset to the governor's authority in these circumstances, but of course it is also a serious liability. The wedding party bombing in the summer of 2008, which some of you might remember, for example, came up in nearly every conversation I had in Nangarhar last summer. Even opponents of the governor explained to me that Shirzai's established relationships with local tribal leaders ensured their calm in this explosive situation. One university professor in Nangarhar said the following to me: "In a democracy, people's ideas should be collected, and this is what the governor is doing. He is not a dictator. He has collected people's ideas and involved them in the decision-making process." Now, I don't think many of us would frame Governor Shirzai's methods as democratic, but I found very consistent throughout the interviews that I did this notion of consultation and the desire to have different constituencies on board as a hallmark of Governor Shirzai's approach. After spending time watching the governor and his staff work, it became quite clear to me that Governor Shirzai has no real inclination to cultivate formal capacity of his provincial administration. He governs almost exclusively in the domain of informal politics, spending his time focused on the ceremonial aspects of rule rather than the substantive work of governing. His feasts and his concerts, his beautiful parks and stadiums seem to serve as his own measures of success. His closest advisors are not technocratic specialists, but elders with important ties to the tribal networks of Nangarhar and young men who serve as little more than thugs and sycophants that surround him. What little institutional development that's happening under in Nangarhar is taking place, I think, without his leadership or even involvement. The director of education at the province, a capable and ambitious bureaucrat, explained to me how he negotiates his way around the sketchy architecture of the provincial administration, ultimately relying on his own direct relationships with donors and the USPRT to get his work done. The governor seems to face little imperative to advance beyond a politics of informal relations so long as he can deliver on the agendas of Kabul and the US, while keeping prominent tribal leaders satisfied. In the meantime, he seems very capable of skimming off the top of all projects that are going on at the provincial level and making a very handsome living while doing it. A reduction of poppy cultivation, coupled with relative stability and significant reconstruction, represent valuable achievements in the Pashtun belt of Afghanistan. So to conclude, the stories of these two governors highlight, I think, the false choice between the maximalist model of good governance and the failed state of anarchic tribalism in Afghanistan. Informal politics practiced by these governors does not yield a technocratic rule, but nor does it represent the absence of any governance at all. Warlord politicians across the country represent the cost of conducting state building as part of a larger strategy to tackle terrorism. Democracy may be the ultimate elixir to extremism, but current instruments of counterterrorism and counterinsurgency seem unlikely to enable democratic governance. In Afghanistan, as elsewhere, international efforts often enable de facto hybrid governance despite promoting a de jure model of statehood based on strong formal institutions. Claims to the contrary create unrealistic expectations and subsequent disappointment and disillusionment on the part of ordinary Afghans and Western citizens alike. And perfection becomes the enemy of good enough. So I think there are three main conclusions we can draw from this analysis. The gap between the de jure model and the de facto hybrid governance reflect first the inadequacies of the maximalist state building model, which does not make room for the persistence of informal institutions and power holders, nor does it allow for suboptimal outcomes, like the good enough outcomes we may see in Balkh and Nangarhar. If these outcomes represent the best we can hope for, we ought to define our goals in more limited and context-specific terms, province by province, district by district, and define our strategies accordingly. Which leads to a second conclusion. As we consider now an additional surge of troops, I think it's important to accept the fact that more military troops does not make the maximalist outcome more likely. The same barriers to good governance I've discussed will still exist. We may see improvements in local security, in the rate of reconstruction, in the growth of security forces, but that progress does not translate into the emergence of a strong, credible democratic state. And third, I want to be clear that hybrid governance, though superior, of course, to failed statehood, is not an inherently stable political space. In fact, the stability of the model fluctuates as a function of the bargaining dynamics that I just described in that triangle between the central government, the international community, and the provincial governors themselves. When I wrote this paper, Governor Atta was a close ally of President Karzai in the north, but as many of you may know, in recent weeks, he has opted to endorse Karzai's main rival, Abdullah Abdullah. If removed from office, for all the reasons I have described, a warlord, Atta Muhammad Noor, and his network of informal power could again become a serious competitor to the state. The international community, where possible, can manage this instability as part of this bargaining triangle, and at a minimum should not exacerbate this instability by neglecting those parts of the country where hybrid governance exists and focusing exclusively on the southern part of the country, which we know is raging at the moment. So with that, I'll close, and I look forward to comments and questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dipali. Gilles, you want to go ahead?
First, I would like to thank you for this paper. We have something concrete to think about. And it's going further than most of the things I have read recently on state building in Afghanistan. I'm going to make a few remarks about the specificities of these two provinces. And then I will go on the state building per se and to finish about a few remarks about the fact that probably this is not a model for the rest of Afghanistan. But first, let's say again that what we are seeing now in Afghanistan is not a process of state building, but exactly the contrary. So there are less and less institutions working every year in Afghanistan. So all the idea that the state building process with this very theological thing that we have a little state and now we'll have a bigger state next year is totally wrong in Afghanistan. What we are seeing is exactly the contrary. So this question, the question you have asked, are extremely important. What we are seeing also is the rearmament of the periphery more and more since 2006, especially. But in the north, it's absolutely clear. And the second point I would like to make in introduction is that there is a fallacy in Afghanistan about everything is local, you know. Not everything is not local in Afghanistan. That's why the network, for example, are very often national or transnational and not local. That's why somebody like Sherzai can be governor of Jalalabad because of his connection through Kandahar. To the state, to Amit Karzai at least. And that's why also the local, there is no local stability possible in Afghanistan. You cannot stabilize one district, one province, because all the rest of the country is moving, you know. So the idea that you can isolate something in Afghanistan and say, okay, we are going to have a local equilibrium here, never worked, and of course it's not going to work. So what I found interesting in this paper is that it's not about local exactly. It's about a model working somewhere between the state and, let's say, more smaller and local actors. It's just the in-between that is interesting, not the local per se. So my first point is about the two examples that have been chosen, you know. First, it's big cities. It's two of the biggest cities of Afghanistan. We are not speaking of the countryside here. Because in the countryside, most of the time, or all the time, local commanders, I would not say, I would not use warlord because, you know, there's a lot of theoretical problem with this word, but I would say commanders. Local commanders are not, have never been a way to build some kind of even hybrid administration. It's just a way to be autonomous from the state. So two big cities, but especially two cities that has been extremely quiet since the beginning of the civil war. And just walk in Jalalabad or walk in Mazar-e-Sharif, better to walk in Mazar-e-Sharif, by the way, and you will see that the cities are perfectly intact. It's not Kabul, it's not Kandahar, or even it's not Herat. Intact, why? Because the guerrilla has never been inside the city. Yeah. And there was a very strong communist party in Jalalabad, we have to remember, and the same thing for Mazar-e-Sharif. So these cities do not have an history of internal violence, except for Mazar-e-Sharif around 94, when those two men and Ustad Atta, I mean, Atta Mohammad, were fighting inside the city. But most of the time, these places have been quiet. So here we have a problem. The fact that these places are probably the best places in Afghanistan to live in, I think, is probably not due to the fact that you have this so-called warlord, or I would say commanders or strong men in these places. It's more the contrary. These places are producing people like that. And I would say we have an example of that. It's the city of Herat, where the state has chosen to marginalize Ismail Khan, who was the big leader of Herat, with very bad consequences on the security. So I would say it's working like that. Some places are producing leader and stability for very, very precise reasons. And if you break this local political equilibrium, you have a good chance, a good probability to have instability. Yeah. So, in very concrete terms, it's not time to move Ustad Atta from from Mazar-e-Sharif, and better to leave Shirzai for the time. The second thing is that we cannot, especially in the case of Shirzai, we are in a very strange and paradoxical situation. Shirzai was appointed by Hamid Karzai, because the situation in Jalalabad was becoming tense. There was the assassination of the historical leader of the place, Haji Kadir, in June 2002. And after that, the place was kind of unstable. And for Hamid Karzai, it was a way to put a new leader from outside. So what's the idea here? It's possible to have a strong leader who is not a local leader. That's a very important thing in Afghanistan. And if you remember the way the Taliban disarm and stabilize most of Afghanistan, it's by putting people who were outsiders. Outsider, but not stupid. Means they were in charge, they knew the people, but they were outsiders. Because outsiders are a kind of neutrality in Afghanistan. A big advantage of Shirzai, actually, is that he's not from one tribe, local tribe, he's Barakzai, so there are no Barakzai, as far as I know, in this place. And so it's a way to produce, not necessarily a state exactly, but to produce a kind of stability. Outsiders are not always bad in Afghanistan. The problem is that we are no more outsiders. We are not seen as outsiders in Afghanistan. We are seen as a fighting tribe, in a way. That was more or less what I wanted to say for the first point. The second thing is that these two places are interesting because you have stability, I mean, no big security problem. You have money, plenty of money, local money, money from outside. The case of Jalalabad is interesting, by the way, because this city is more and more like Pakistan. People are asking you to pay in Kaldor, in Pakistani money, as you know, in the bazaar. It's quite surprising at the beginning. Everything is Pakistani. You have rickshaw. You don't have much rickshaw outside Kabul also. But, you know, there is something like Pakistani, you know. And money, stability, but not state building. Not really, you know. What's amazing, after, let's say, five or 6 years in the north, where Ustadatta was mostly in charge, where there was no security problem, is that you don't find more police, really. You don't find more basic institution, like justice, like, you know, you don't find all that. So peace and development do not produce state. That's extremely interesting as such. Means that if you want, you know, this idea that you're going to stabilize one part of Afghanistan after a few years, you have the spontaneous emergence of the state, that is not true, you know. The state cannot be built by the periphery. The state is a central thing. It's always top-down. Here it's a direct attack against the so-called idea of empowerment of local communities. That is, of course, not working, producing a lot of conflict, and is extremely dangerous on the long run. So the last thing probably is about what we can draw from that. I mean, is that a general model? Is that a local model? How does it work? First thing, we have to be clear about one thing, is that the political geography in Afghanistan is very clear about the fact that you can have this kind of strongmen in the north much more than in the south. South means south of Jalalabad, Pashtun areas. You don't have this kind of strongmen. Even Kandahar could be constructed as an example of that. It's not working the same way. So this kind of strongmen are more produced by the cities and by the north, not by the south. Of course, that's major importance if you want to build a strategy in Afghanistan, to understand that it's not working the same way. Okay, you have a dustum in the north, you don't have dustum in the south. Yeah? That was the first point. The second point is that we should not wait from the local to make the decision about the state building or to spontaneously find a state where there is just local people living their life and making economical choice or whatever. We have to build a state from outside, from the top. And I think Jalalabad is interesting this way, probably with outsiders to a certain point in situation where there is a local conflict. And here we have a very interesting example, even if it's a wrong example. I mean, it's what Karzai has done in 2002, 2003, 2004. Systematically in places, he has appointed governors that were very, 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 very inexperienced, violent, and they deconstruct the idea, even the idea of the state in some places. And we have to think about that and to think that if we had, at that time, a better appointments, it would have been a key thing in the rebuilding of the state. So who is governor is a key point. It's not a marginal thing. It's really one central problem with Karzai right now, that all the people he's appointing are mostly people who are not able, actually, to make local deals, to build something like a beginning of the state, especially in the south. That's, I think, the second conclusion we can draw from that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marvin.
Yeah. Well, I think we're here because we're curious about warlords, and certainly the term, as has already been suggested, is some people view as pejorative. We're really, as has been suggested here, talking about commanders. When they have the scope of regional power, we give them the, and especially if we don't like them, we refer to them as warlords. well, we've associated mostly warlords with corruption, with violation of human rights, and therefore seen as impediments to the kind of political system that we presume the Afghans want for themselves, and certainly we seem to wish they had. We've seen warlords as well become very prominent of late by virtue of the fact that in this recent election, which I want to come back to, Karzai has supposedly surrounded himself with inclusion in his campaign, as people he sought support for, in fact, people on his ticket who have been labeled warlords. And we're especially interested in that because of their notoriety, generally speaking, negative notoriety, and also because of these seeming constraints that they place on him in terms of future development, direction of the country. You know, it's easy to forget that warlords are not a traditional part of the political landscape in Afghanistan. Most of the time, people say, well, you know, they've always had warlords, they always will. Actually, informal leadership, which is certainly characteristic of the country, is something we are has been there. But warlords are a product of the jihad of the 1980s and the civil wars that followed, and the diminution and sometimes a dismantling of traditional leadership, which was in the hands of village elders and tribal leaders. But these early informal leaders were of a different breed. In the past, Afghanistan was a largely egalitarian society. One of the things that stand out if you went around was to see that the local power broker didn't live that much better, or at least not ostentatiously, from the others. And this was an important part. That has, by and large, of course, changed. Their power derived primarily from the deference accorded according to their lineage and their social status in the tribe or sub-tribe, or in the case of the non-tribalized North clan. When they assumed the mantle of some authority under the state, it was believed to be their due. The current crop of warlords mainly derived from the anti-Soviet jihad and some communists, former communist commanders and communist officials, and all of them, almost all of them, are without strong social credentials. Throughout much of Afghan history, there's been, as is suggested by DePauli's discussion, a modus vivendi between the center and the periphery. The central or national government imbued with enough legitimacy and power to implement those functions that were considered minimally to define what a nation state is all about, an ability to put down insurrections, negotiate with foreign powers, extract revenue, and at the same time, and some other functions, and at the same time, an appreciation at the center of the limitations of their reach and scope of authority. Little is expected of the state by the public in the way of deliveries of goods and services, and the state didn't disappoint them. So this relationship between periphery and center is mirrored in the current weak formal institutions and significant informal power that DePauli depicts so well in this study, in this, I believe, strong analysis that she's presented. The study warns us against, as we're often tempted, and she alluded to, associating state building with effective governance, or effective governance, and linking that, linking state building and effective governance. We're accustomed to looking at the exercise of formal powers as somehow furthering that, and whereas those who rely on informal powers are viewed as being obstacles. I think DePauli has has dealt with that quite well. What's changed from the past, and there has been a change, is that the public does expect more from their central and also their local government. And in this, I might be differing a bit with Jails. Expect more in their capacity to deliver basic security, improvement of their lives, and provide a modicum of justice. This is in so large a part, I think, of the reason that Kabul, in the post 2001 period, lost the trust and confidence of the people. But also why, and I agree with Dipali here, that the hybrid model offers us some way forward. Dipali's hybrid model of governance is a way of looking how the informal and the formal modes of governance can fruitfully intersect and overlap. For Dipali's model here is both descriptive and prescriptive. What is and what can be, what should be. And it may be, as she suggests, the only viable way to go and the best compromise. The hybrid applies to a system-level understanding, but is also embodied in individuals. And here, Dipali offers us the two warlords who seem to exemplify it. Importantly, she suggested that Atta and Sherzai can be seen conceivably, and she didn't mention this, I think, in her remarks here, as transitional figures here, seeing perhaps that this is the way forward here, and that this could very well be a model that we would look for in others. As such, they are seen of a being representative of a leadership phenomenon at a particular stage in Afghanistan's state building project, which I believe has been going on in fits and starts since Abdul Rahman. But also in, and Gilles mentions this, we also have to recognize that happenstance about where they're governing has made them profitable or made these rules profitable or not in their unique blending of the two roles, the formal and the informal. Now, some say that warlords are less integrated into the political process with its constraints then, let me just say here that that these two warlords here that we're discussing and the constraints on them, they in effect are less integrated in that process and have used the political process to avail themselves of resources enabling them to consolidate their power. General Atta has, as has already been suggested, acted like anything like a responsible political actor in his dispute with his Uzbek rivals or in his recent behavior in the election. There's good reason to believe that General Atta was as guilty and his people of rigging in the election as was occurring in the South. It's almost certain that, as has been suggested here, that he will be removed. So this, I don't think it will take away from the points that Dipali is making, but we won't have him to kick around, at least. Agul Aga Sherzai has delivered better governance in terms of basic security and services, but his performance as governor of Kandahar, at least at the time, was viewed as anything less than a model of behavior. If he's shown different colors in Jalalabad, a lot has to do with where he has taken up residence. Because informal politics is personalized and patronage politics, it's thus obviously contingent upon the political and physical survival of the individuals and thus of questionable sustainability. Well, how compatible is this with state-building policies that require a continuity, continuous commitment. One of the greatest complaints of ordinary people who seek, for example, to use the formal justice system, as primitive as it is that no decision, for example, is permanent. Even if a ruling goes in their favor, nothing is there to prevent the next local power figure from reopening the issue and having an earlier decision reversed. The current electoral crisis that we're all observing now can be seen as a confrontation between the quest for formal institutions and the reality of informally exercised power. It appears to indicate that, at least in this incidents, their incompatibility rather than coexistence. Warlords and commanders may and did have to demonstrate here their power. And here I'm using local as well, commanders when talking about informal power. They had to demonstrate their power, even if it meant stealing and ultimately discrediting an election which they and their allies had actually won. But there are other examples of where they do coexist nicely. The informal choice of representatives in the two Jurgas, lawyer Jurgas that were called since 2002, were able to take responsibility for the country's political framework. Many believe that we'd be better off today without an elected parliament, and if we had gone with more traditional means of representation, at least in the short and medium term. No doubt, the loyalty of informal power holders can hold the strongest bulwark against the Taliban insurgency, but it's also the greatest weakness. As often pointed out, their loyalties are always contingent. Almost finished. Survival means having to be on the winning side, whether it's an election or an insurgency. Much of the local strength of the Taliban comes from militia commanders and the tribal leaders overtly and covertly aligning with the Taliban. There's considerable discussion here about trying to integrate the Taliban into the political process. This, of course, if we're talking about Mullah Omar and those who are ideologically inclined, would represent the ultimate and perhaps impossible test of the hybrid model in any effort to bring them on board. But still, it may be if we define, as we have to, the Taliban in a much less monolithic way, be the only way in which ultimately we will find a political solution. The best fit for Dalapi's leadership model for bringing a stable and reasonably functional minimal state may indeed be represented by Atta and Sherzai and their different formulas for governing. The pity is that these two are perhaps the best, as well as the most accessible, the best that you could find in Afghanistan. And it seems to me that if Afghanistan and we are going to be better off, she's got to have more choice when you do your next study.
Thank you very much. Let me sort of take the prerogative of the chair, and I want to make one, just one comment and then more of an announcement. The comment is on the fact that I think there are a lot of caveats in Dipali's paper. There is a search on, not so much in the academic world, but on the part of all the agencies, that government agencies from various countries that are engaged in these reconstruction efforts. There is a new mantra out there, which is that of the good enough governance. I think Dipali mentioned it, that there is a realization that the idea that somehow we were going to be able to build this full-fledged democratic state with all the great virtues of a democratic state is simply pie in the sky, that it's not going to happen anytime soon in any of these post-conflict situations. So there is a new formula now that it's beginning to appear all the time at all the discussions of these reconstruction situations, and that is that of good enough governance. Good enough governance, I mean, yes, of course, you do the best you can, and that's really what it means. But there is no single model. That there is, I mean, I think what worries me is that what I see is the search for yet another model, essentially, a more minimal model, but still a model that then can be implemented everywhere. And I think what one really take away from the Paris paper is the fact that here you have one country and two examples that are totally different from each other. And it seems to me that if she had the possibility of doing more studies, I think she would find, more case studies, she would find that in every province, no matter who the governor is, there is the same kind of informal accommodation between, and more or less successful, between the formal structure of the state and whatever existed there at the informal level. So it's much more saying good enough governance, essentially, does not mean very much. The second point is really an announcement. There are unfortunately a lot of countries where the state is failing. The state, as envisaged by the international community at one point, is failing. We have a study coming out very soon of another one of the states that are deeply troubled, and that's Yemen. We will have, I cannot tell you save the date because we don't have a date yet, but somewhere in mid-October we are going to have a launch of Chris Bosak paper on Yemen that's going to raise, you know, a lot of the same questions. So stay tuned for that. And with that, I open the floor. Please identify yourself. And there are microphones around. Yes.
Thank you. Masood Aziz from Afghanistan. Thank you for the report. I think very informed. Although I think that the notion that the hybrid model that you have described could be a model for Afghanistan is something that I can't really agree with. I think the panel members mentioned that to some extent, you know, everything is hybrid in Afghanistan. I'm not sure what's not. Also, a bit of context would have been interesting to have because of the complexity of the relationships that exist, even for just these two warlords. You can't really speak of them. I think you mentioned them, but I'm not sure if it was detailed enough. Otherwise, the relationship between the dynamic between Dostum and Atta is very important, and what's happened now in regards to that is extremely important in the relationship that they had and what they've done before. Also, to just pick on what Gilles said, to have state building in a way helped by the outside is also a notion that, in fact, has been tried before that I don't believe would actually be fitting the future of this country in terms of its dynamic itself. So the failure, in fact, of state building in Afghanistan, if one thing can be said, is largely due to the fact that warlords were empowered in a way by themselves, and at the same time, the central government, in a way, was not helped in its capacity. After a while, this is really at one of the core issues of what state building is. So I guess one of the things I would like to ask the panel to look into is what Marvin mentioned is that warlords are not really connected to the traditions of this country. Otherwise, the Jirga and the Shura traditions at the village and local levels, what can be done to leverage that? And some attempts have been done in the past, in recent past, in via that process connecting the periphery to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Aziz, for your comments. I guess I'll just respond to your comments by saying the following. First, I agree with both you and Marvin, and write about it in my paper, that the warlords are not connected to the traditions of informal politics, informal justice in Afghanistan. And they represent, in fact, a new phenomenon. I don't disagree with you that the failure of state building as it was envisioned can be attributed in part to the inclusion of these actors. I think my argument is simply that the only reason that we're pursuing the state building project in Afghanistan today is because of the counterterrorism imperative that arose after September 11th. For better or for worse, that's why we're there. And so the decision was made to partner with these commanders, but then the decision was also made to not field a major international enforcement presence on the ground, which could have provided perhaps the coercive support to the new Karzai government to manage or disarm or demobilize these warlords in more substantial ways. But I think that didn't happen, and so we are now where we are today. I think I want to talk a bit about this idea of hybrid governance. Can it be a model that works or that doesn't work for Afghanistan? I deliberately did not frame the notion of hybrid governance as a model to be applied across the country or in other countries. It's more, for me, an analytical concept to understand what's actually happening on the ground in these two provinces. I think it's not an optimal outcome, and for that it makes perfectly good sense that you feel it's a model that shouldn't be applied across the country. I think my question would simply be, do you see anything better happening in any other part of the country? And if yes, what are the ingredients that exist there that are delivering a better outcome? Because my experience was that these two provinces are actually, for all of the reasons that Sheel mentioned, many of which don't have anything to do with the governors themselves, are considered two of the better cities, better provinces to be in right now in Afghanistan, and yet there are a lot of costs we know that exist from having these kind of actors in power. You mentioned the rivalry between Atta and Dostum, which I didn't have space in this paper to get into as much, but it's a very important part of the dynamic since before 2001, but especially today. And I was telling Gilles yesterday, I still don't quite understand Karzai's decision to take Dostum's support. To me, that struck me as a very desperate short-term kind of strategy. And presumably he promised him something in return for delivering some large portion of the Uzbek vote. And we don't know what that promise was, but if it involves him going back to the north, then I think we can be quite sure that the situation will become once again unstable, which is why I mentioned that I think this hybrid governance model has in part to do with what the provincial governors themselves do, but also has to do with the relationships between these governors and the regime in Kabul and the internationals who are supporting the regime.
Okay, thank you.
Masoud, your assertion that state building can't come from the outside, I think if you're referring to the fact we can't impose a state, by the way, let's get away from nation building here. I know all of the statements that are being made refer to nation building in the press and elsewhere. Afghanistan is not in the process of nation building. That's a problem of identity, and that's a very different matter than building institutions, building processes, which we refer to as state building. And I wish people would begin to get that right. I don't think, Masoud, anybody believes that. On the other hand, the idea that outside forces, outside sources, can't assist in the process of state building flies, in fact, in face of you know, what particularly we have seen historically. Again, they can't impose it, but that they can provide resources and models. We see it all the time. After all, the Afghan constitution of 64 was a borrowed constitution from the Belgians. So I think outside influences play an enormous role in here. And that, by the way, that's true for the Iranian constitution and true for our constitution as well. But it's more than that. I'm talking about the wherewithal to be able to construct a state. And just quickly, yeah, it's an analytic device. But, Polly, I wouldn't want you to back away entirely, because I think Masoud is right that everything is hybrid. Of course, it's going to be some combination of a state trying to exercise its political power and more customary, more personal kinds of influences. Of course, it is. It's a question of what the combination of the two will be and what the balance between the two will be. Okay.
Time for one more question. You had your hand up, right? Anything else we can round up? Okay, go ahead.
Marco Scuriatti from the World Bank. And first of all, Dipali, thank you so much for your excellent presentation and also the panelists. I think it gives us a lot of food for thought. And me coming more from the development side equation. But Chain, the way you pose it, and I think we agree that we have not been successful over the last 7 years, 6 years, in setting up the structure for the maximalist state, and like Mr. Masoud here mentioned, but it's all been very hybrid. But I'm questioning if we just change the paradigm of it all and really move towards more a hybrid governance and put it out there, the implications that this has for the overall development assistance, because obviously the maximalist model plays very well into the hands of development assistance, which we've been financing to the tune of over $40 billion over the last several years, 7 years. So, again, if we move into this direction, which I think is the natural way to move towards, to what would this mean in terms of would the international community phase out of Afghanistan? Would it become a much more homegrown? Would we be delinking it so we don't hear that much in the news? Again, I think we would be changing the whole paradigm and thinking, and we would be talking more about disengagement. And we probably wouldn't be here 2 or 3 years from now talking, oh, my God, what are we going to do about Afghanistan? Because we just give it more over to the Afghans. So, I mean, it's not quite a question, but more of a comment or something to think about. But where do we go from here, knowing that we cannot absolutely put in a maximalist state? Thank you.
Yeah, I think this is an extraordinarily difficult and important question, which usually, as an academic, I don't have to answer. But I think this is the central problem, because once the paradigm is out there, and as Marvin said, it's not something that's just being thrust, for example, on Afghans against their will. It's, in fact, what they now expect and are looking for. It's very hard to then ratchet down the model. So I think probably the first step would be to set aside the formula of that I drew in that pyramid, you know, of all of the building blocks that have been identified, and say that, as Marvin was saying before, in the Afghan context, there are certain institutions, certain political mechanisms that have worked. Elections, for example, have historically has not been one of them. Their other parliament has not historically been one of them. So there are a number of ways in which one can be more context-specific in one's analysis when considering development programming. But I think it's also then about understanding the limits of one's own organization and recognizing that there are, in fact, ways that politics and law and economics are practiced on the ground in these different countries that are functional, that don't meet necessarily the standards in Western states, but that there may be knowledge and capacity on the ground that exists that could be tapped into rather than always thinking about what development organizations can bring to a situation. So I think, I mean, those are two very humble responses, but I think this is the ultimate question that we don't have an answer to yet. Can we ratchet down the model in terms of delivery? And we don't think, I don't think we know yet.
Just wanted to mention that, yes, I think initially in Afghanistan and for some time, we had too much of the thought of a strong, not a strong central government, but a capable central government, and took us a long time to realize that this was not attainable. But that was natural from international agencies and governments to try to work through central government. These institutions are not used to working through local governments. When they deliver assistance, when they relate to central figures. And so this was a natural outcome. But what has happened now is that we're desperately trying to look for means now to be able to bypass the central government without delegitimizing the central government. Because for all we can say is that if it's going to be a modern nation state, it's got to have a legitimate center. What its capacity will be, what its penetration will be, is another matter. And let's also accept the fact that Afghanistan is going to be, as long as it doesn't want to be a Miramar, it's going to be a dependent state. It's always going to be a dependent state. The question is only, whose dependent is it going to be?
I think we are running out of time. This time I'm not going to give you that question. Thank you very much, and please help me in thanking Vitaly and the other people.